We'll call the meeting of the House Tax Committee to order. The hour of 10:15 having arrived, February 2nd, 2011. We have on our agenda today House File 103, so if Representative Murray could please come to the table. And Representative Murray, as soon as we actually have a quorum, we'll start to hear your bill because there's some folks I know that want to testify. We will break in and get the meeting officially going. So with that, Representative Murray, welcome to the House Tax Committee. I will move House File 103 be recommended pass and sent to Representative Murray. Does this need to go to like Ways and Means or right to the floor?
That is correct, Mr. Chairman. Ways and Means.
Ways and Means. Heard next. My motion will be when we have a quorum here to move House File 103 to the Ways and Means Committee. Okay, so Representative Murray, welcome to the Tax Committee. If you could please explain your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. My name is Rich Murray. I'm a representative from 27A in southern Minnesota, which encompasses Freeborn County and nine precincts in Maurer County. Our bill today, HF 103, has two parts to it. The first part of the bill is regarding family-owned business provision, and what it does is it restores the opportunity for adult children of business owners to receive unemployment benefits to the same extent as any other employee. Under a change enacted last year, employees of a family-owned business who are the owner's children are limited to receiving a maximum of 5 weeks of state unemployment benefits plus 11 weeks of federal benefits. Previously, the limitation had only applied to the owner's spouse, parent, or minor child. The change in this will be made by reinstating the word minor in the bill on line 1.1. We are estimating that the cost to the unemployment trust fund on this bill is going to be in the range of 1.5.
Excuse me, Representative Murray, I believe it's 1.10.
That is correct, Mr. Chairman, 1.10. Thank you. We are estimating
the cost. Representative Murray, we'll officially call a meeting of the House Tax Committee to order. I will move House File 103 be recommended to pass and sent to the committee, the Ways and Means Committee. Please proceed, Representative Murray.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As I was stating, we believe the cost to the Unemployment Trust Fund is estimated at about $1.5 million to $2 million for the current year. The second portion of the bill is a federal extension benefit provision on unemployment benefits, and this regards the unemployment extension that the federal government passed in December. The change allows unemployed Minnesotans to receive federal extended unemployment benefits once their state and other federal benefits are exhausted. Congress voted in December of 2010 to extend the time period that benefits are available until the end of this year. The latest extension will provide an additional 13 weeks of extended benefits. These benefits are funded 100% by the federal government, so extension will not increase the state's UI trust fund deficit. Under current state law, extended benefits will cease in the middle of March because the state unemployment rate, although still high, hasn't increased fast enough to continue to qualify for the federal extension. What House File 103 would do, the proposed change, is that we would change the qualifying threshold. Under this change, if the current rate of unemployment is 10% higher than it was over the same period in any of the past 3 years, the state would qualify for these extended benefits. This is a change that's allowed under the federal law in recognition that this recession has been deep and protracted. This bill will allow 55,000 unemployed Minnesotans to continue to collect benefits, and it's estimated that $160 million, again, entirely funded by the federal government, will come into the state to these 55,000 unemployed Minnesotans. And I think the economic impact of that $160 million is the best part of this bill. And I will stop and answer questions then.
Okay, a couple items here. First of all, is there anyone that wishes to testify against House File 103? Against. Okay, then we'll hear from Mr. Lee Nelson in a minute here to if you have some things to say or as a resource for questions here. But first of all, we have a very important item here we need to take care of. The 9th and 10th grade students from the Great River School in St. Paul are here today to see how a committee is run. And so are they here? Thanks for your support there, members. And so the St. Paul delegation, who I believe is comprised right now of Representative Paymar and Representative Lesh would be in that. Are there anybody else from St. Paul on the tax committee? So the St. Paul delegation and the tax committee welcomes the 9th and 10th grade students from Great River School in St. Paul.
Mr. Chair, they're
Erickson.
Mr. Chair, they're a charter school, so they're here to learn about government. That's good.
That's a good thing. Representative Marquardt, you know, displayed to us, I thought, quite a bit of brilliance yesterday with his 1968 St. Louis Cardinals, who were always the archenemies of the 68 Cubs. But with that being said, in the studies he's done there, I'm sure he's read the minutes and would be happy to move the minutes. Any additions or corrections? Representative Marquardt moves the minutes. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Marquardt. Okay, so with that, Mr. Nelson, you can please identify yourself and who you represent and make some comments on the department's position on House File 103.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I am Lee Nelson. I am legal counsel to the Unemployment Insurance Program, and I am an employee of the Department of Employment and Economic Development. What I would like to say in regards to House File 103 is the department fully supports this bill and encourages quick enactment by the legislature, primarily because of the time sensitivity of Section 2. I think Representative Murray described the bill very, very well. I can answer any member's question regarding the history on Section 1, why the changes that are done regarding Section 2, or any other question regarding the unemployment insurance program. Thank you,
Mr. Nelson. Before we do that, Representative Marquardt moves to rescind his motion on the minutes. Members, we have a motion on the floor or before the committee, so Representative Marquardt was out of order. So Representative Marquardt moves to rescind the motion. We'll do it after the bill is taken care of. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Sorry. Okay, questions for the author on House File 103. Or Mr. Nelson from the department, Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, Representative Murray, first of all, thank you for bringing this piece of legislation forward. Good work on this. Mr. Nelson, I have some constituents of mine who have contacted me regarding the change in minor definition for under Section 1, and they were currently being told that they need to actually pay back benefits because of the retroactivity portion of the definition. Are you familiar with this issue, or have you seen other constituents facing this matter?
Mr. Nelson?
Or other citizens, I should say.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Garofalo, I'm not aware of any retroactivity provisions. What may have occurred, and this occurs regarding unemployment benefits generally, is maybe the information is not fully provided up front, so we don't discover until later that they are, in fact, a family member. It is until after benefits are already paid out that it later becomes discovered. Maybe it was just missed. That happens when you have 370,000 applications for unemployment benefits filed last year. Not everything worked absolutely perfectly. But that would be the only reason. It may have been not identified up front or not fully disclosed, either for any number of reasons.
And Mr. Chairman.
Representative Garofalo.
And Mr. Nelson, just so I understand there's always different hypotheticals, but in that situation, the statutory changes we made last year where we changed the definition, I believe it was effective July 1st, correct? Is that when the definition of with regards to children or minor children, when that change went into effect?
Mr. Nelson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Garofalo, yes, it was effective July 1st that the word minor was removed, and therefore the limitation applied to all children of a business owner.
Not Mr. Chairman.
Representative Garofalo.
And Mr. Nelson, so and I just want to make sure I understand it right, and I won't hold you to this, we can maybe perhaps speak after the meeting, but would there be any reason why people who collected benefits in the first half of the year who were affected by that because their father or their mother owned a business, would there be any situation where they would have to pay back benefits previous to that July 1st?
Mr. Chairman,
Mr. Nelson,
Garofalo, no. Okay. They would not be if they were required to pay back benefits. It was not for this reason. It would have been for some other reason. But this provision did not apply to any benefits paid prior to July 1st of 2010.
Representative Garofalo?
Thank you. And then, Mr. Nelson, my final question, just to be clear, we're going back here. This is a retroactive change. So benefits that people were not collecting in the end of calendar year 10, the beginning of 11, these benefits will be available to them retroactively, or is it just going forward?
Mr. Nelson?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Garofalo, it would be retroactive, so as the law never existed. So if somebody was denied benefits last August, they would be provided those benefits for those weeks they were unemployed in August.
Mr. Chairman,
Garofalo?
And Mr. Nelson, Representative Murray, thank you again for bringing this forward. I really appreciate it.
Any other questions? Representative Loeffler, and then Paymar. Representative Loeffler?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members. I understand Section 2, and I think we definitely need to do that. I'm still trying to understand unemployment insurance, and I know from an earlier hearing I was at with Mr. Lee, it's very complicated. but my understanding in Section 1 is that this issue arises a lot with seasonal businesses, as well as other businesses that are just hitting hard times and, you know, they have to lay off people because they don't have the customer base or they're going out of business or whatever the circumstance is. But I wanted to know, are people who are in seasonal businesses, you know, that might only operate 4 or 5 months out of the year, are they expected, like other people on unemployment, to be actively seeking other work during that period between that 4 to 5 months? Is this a consistent way to treat everyone who's in a business that isn't year-round? I mean, there's all kinds of different businesses that, you know, from schools to all kinds of different things that don't operate year-round. Do we apply the rules consistently? And so this is just a correction related to a parental-owned business?
Mr. Nelson?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, law does not exempt a person who's unemployed seasonally or even temporarily from the requirements of being available for work and actively seeking work. So there are no special exemptions for people who are seasonally unemployed. And this provision only applies to family members of business owners. Minnesota has had a provision regarding family members since the early 80s. There are about 6 or 8 states which have somewhat similar provisions. I should point out that this has an exclusion for non-seasonal. It really was intended, and it doesn't work very well, but it was intended to apply only to seasonal businesses, a limitation for business owners and direct family members. That was the intent of it. It doesn't work as perfectly as one might like, and it's difficult to administer, but its intent is to limit family-owned businesses from essentially taking out substantially more from the unemployment fund than the business ever pays in. There are maximum taxes in Minnesota. A highly seasonal business doesn't pay the cost of the benefits paid to their workers. And this is a limitation so business owners and their families couldn't take out substantially more than they ever paid in. That was the intent of this particular provision.
Person of Loeffler.
Just to follow up, and I really don't know much about this system, but is the contribution to the unemployment insurance fund by the business, is that a uniform contribution, or does it vary by industry? So if the taking out more than they contribute in, is that a factor of us not setting the payment rates in appropriately by class, or is it a uniform contribution across all employers?
Mr. Nelson?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, first of all, each employer pays in relation to the layoffs in the past. It isn't by industry. It isn't set by class of employers. Each business is rated individually based on the benefits paid out in the past. Unemployment benefit costs are not prepaid by employers. They're postpaid. benefits are paid from the fund, and then that individual employer's experience rating will increase, their tax rate will then increase, so the fund is replenished for the benefits paid out. But there is a maximum tax. And so if you're a highly seasonal business, workers are taking out a lot more than the business is paying in. And the business owner provision here was put in place in an attempt to limit the amount that a family business and family members could then take out of a fund, which would not be replenished by the business. But a large misconception about unemployment insurance is that if an employer pays in, that covers the cost in the future. No, what they pay in covers what was done before. Now, if you have a business which goes out of business, the fund doesn't get anything. So some of those minimum taxes an employer pays if they never have layoffs go to pay for those businesses which have gone out of business, and thus the cost can't be recovered.
One last follow-up. Thank you. You always do a nice job of explaining things. Now that I understand that, does that mean that the beneficiaries of this law change would actually end up having their taxes increased in the future, their contributions increased in the future, because this will actually increase their liability, and since they pay it in the future based on past experience, that they'll actually get some relief now, but actually their rates will get higher in the future?
Mr. Nelson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, again, these are highly supplies in most instances, we can always come up with most instances, highly seasonal businesses. They're paying at the maximum rates. So what this means is, Representative explained, this is going to cost the unemployment insurance trust fund some money. All other employers, that $1.5 million to $2 million, will be spread to all Minnesota employers. And again, that's why they have to end up paying a minimum, because nobody pays that cost. It's spread to all employers. The individual employers aren't going to see higher taxes in most instances because they're already at the maximum tax rate. Simply means that Minnesota businesses will pick up that $1.5 million to $2 million estimated cost per year.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you. I'm still weighing whether that's a fair trade-off or not. Thank you.
Representative Paymar.
Ms. Nelson, so what is the current deficit of the unemployment trust fund, I understand it's quite high, and is the federal government back that up, or is this something that state businesses are just on the hook for?
Mr. Nelson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Paymar, as of last Friday, the Unemployment Insurance Trust Fund was $609,660,000 in deficit. That is not unique. Minnesota has been in deficit in the 70s and the 80s and in 2002 and 3. In relative terms, we were in much worse shape in the mid-80s. We borrow essentially from the Federal Treasury. And starting on January 1st of this year, Minnesota businesses will have to pay interest on that borrowed funds and the average daily balance. And there's a special assessment going to be taxed onto all Minnesota businesses when they pay their quarterly taxes in April of this year to help pay that interest cost. Current interest rate is just over 4%. But we borrow from the Federal Trust Fund. There are 31 states currently in deficit. Virtually all large states are in deficit. Only the state of Washington, of the larger states, is not in deficit. The states are currently $41 billion nationally in deficit to the Federal Treasury to pay unemployment benefits. Wisconsin is in far worse shape than Minnesota. Minnesota, we are currently projected to be out of deficit by around the end of 2013. Hopefully with no downturn in the economy. We're projected currently to be out of deficit. Again, because benefits are paid out and then employer taxes increase through that experience rating and the fund is replenished. It is simply taking time to recover. We entered this recession with not enough reserve to be able to weather it. We entered this recession with only $700 million in reserves at the end of 2007, excuse me, and then we hit in late 2008 and benefits started to be paying out very quickly. The system just isn't built enough to react when payments escalate so quickly. and so it takes a little time to recover, and that's what's occurring now. And again, borrowing is not unique than the past.
Representative Paymar?
That's good explanation. Thank you.
And we've had Representative Lesh join us. Representative Lesh, there is a group of students here from the 9th and 10th grade, students from the Great River School in St. Paul. So we welcome them, and he is the other half of our...
I didn't clap. Thank you for the opportunity.
Okay, Representative Downey, is anyone else like to ask some questions of Mr. Nelson or Representative Murray? Representative Downey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just some background data, Mr. Nelson. I remember vaguely from a committee hearing last year where some number was given, and my recollection was that it was like $2.4 billion. I could be wrong, in unemployment benefits, either federal or state, that had been deployed, if you will, in the state of Minnesota. Can you just give us a little bit of history? You talked about the big number in deficit that we're borrowing from the feds right now. What actually have we as a state, in combination with the federal government, paid out in unemployment benefits here in Minnesota, say, each of the last 2 years, just so we have a sense of the magnitude?
Mr. Chairman Nelson. Mr. Chairman, President Downey, in each of the past 2 years, we've paid approximately $2.8 billion in each of those years in total unemployment benefit costs. In 2009, $1.6 billion was paid in regular state benefits from the state trust fund, and then $1.2 billion in federally funded extension. In 2010, we paid $1.4 billion in regular state benefits and $1.4 billion in federal extension.
Representative Downey?
Mr. Chair. And then the could you briefly describe the interaction of the federal benefits and the state benefits, specifically as it relies or relates to this particular extension? Is there any state commitment, or is this exclusively federal unemployment benefits coming to Minnesota recipients?
Mr. Nelson?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Downey, currently in Minnesota, individual unemployed in Minnesota can receive up to 26 weeks of regular state benefits. Then they can receive, the numbers up, I believe it's 47 weeks of a pure federal extension. Then after that, there's an additional 13 weeks of we call federal state benefits. Section 2 deals with that last extension of 13 weeks. That is all federally funded. And you'll note this bill is limited so that if the federal government at some point decides to stop paying 100% of it, the bill will immediately trigger off. So there is no liability to the State Unemployment Insurance Trust Fund should Congress choose not to fully fund this extension.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Any other questions? Representative Runbeck?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Nelson.
Representative Runbeck, if you could please speak in the microphone
I'm
so
sorry.
It's picked up on the
sorry.
Tape. Are these aren't tapes anymore, are they, though? Are they DVD things or CDs or digital Blu-rays?
So it's right upstairs.
A-tracks? Okay. Representative Runbeck.
Whoa. Anyway, Mr. Nelson, on the issue of the benefit level paid to people in the program, does Minnesota supplement, I mean, is there a federal average, and then does Minnesota supplement above and beyond that? Where do we stand as far as other states on what we pay out in benefits?
Mr. Nelson?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Runbeck, states all set their own benefit levels. And Minnesota provides 50% of an individual's average weekly wage. There is a maximum in Minnesota that is currently $578 a week. Minnesota's maximum of $578, depending upon whether some states have dependents allowances, Minnesota doesn't. But essentially, we're about fourth or fifth highest in the nation. But again, to get to that maximum of $578, you have to have made about $60,000 a year.
That's right.
So many states have a lot lower maximums. And it also depends on how you determine your average weekly wage. What snapshot in time do you use? Do you use a small snapshot? Do you use a larger snapshot? To get to that 578, again, you have to have earned $60,000 a year. The average payment, so that the average individual who applies for benefits receives about $350 a week. For most people, only about 10% of everyone applying for benefits receives the maximum. In Minnesota's average benefit levels, that $350 is again, high nationally, but Minnesota workers are paid higher wages than national average, too. And many states simply have a low cap. South Dakota, maximum is about $250 a week. So regardless if you made $70,000 in South Dakota, you'd get $270 a week. So, again, Minnesota, we believe that providing a wage replacement of 50% of your average wage means you can get by. You're not you're not banking any money, but you can get by. You can pay, you know, you can eat, pay your rent, which is what the purpose of unemployment benefits are for.
Representative Runbeck?
That's all. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Erickson. And then, members, just so you know, at 11:45, we will be adjourning for the day, and then we've got another tax meeting tomorrow where we'll pick up from the Department of Revenue auditing folks. Because we have a floor session noon, I want to give everybody time to get over there. Representative Runbeck.
It's Erickson.
Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Nelson, what's our present unemployment rate in the state? And could you just briefly explain to us what problems we might be facing from our constituents in regard to the changing laws on unemployment, whether it's extensions by the feds or something else.
Mr. Nelson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Erickson, the current unemployment rate in Minnesota, I believe, is 7%. But one thing I do want to point out is that the unemployment rate and people applying for unemployment benefits, while there's somewhat of a correlation, it's not exactly consistent. People counted as unemployed, essentially, about one-third of those people have not worked. They are new labor market entrants. They may have just graduated from school or something. They may have just decided to return to the labor market. So they wouldn't qualify for unemployment benefits. And also about one-third of job losers never apply for unemployment benefits. They lose their job. They maybe believe they'll get another job. And so at any snapshot in time, one-third of people who lost their job have never applied for unemployment benefits for one reason or another. So those are some of the statistics. I think some of the things members should be concerned about, again, as I indicated, there is going to be a surcharge on employer taxes to pay the interest costs from the federal government, from the borrowed funds.
Mr. Nelson, to that point, what is the size of the surcharge? Is it a percentage or a flat fee?
Mr. Chairman, to your question, it is going to be 2% of the unemployment taxes due in any given quarter will be used. That's going to generate about $26 million between now and September 30th when the interest payment is due on a federal fiscal year.
So, Mr. Nelson, when is that coming out again?
Well, it's going to be 2% on the quarterly taxes due. Quarter taxes are due on April 30th.
April 30th.
30 days after the end of the quarter.
So, members, we may be hearing from constituents about that.
We hear from constituents on that. I think also hearing from constituents because of the federal extensions. Many people are fully exhausting all of those extensions, and there's nothing else available. The federal extensions will expire on December 31st. So those things you're going to hear from constituents on.
Okay, Representative Erickson, and then we'll wrap this up, Representative Erickson. I kind of cut in on you there.
That was very good. That's
okay.
Exactly what
any further discussion? Hearing none. I will renew my motion that House File 103 be recommended, passed, and sent to the Committee of Ways and Means. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Okay, Representative Marquardt moves. This motion is now in order. Moves that the minutes of February 1st be passing. Discussion? Hearing none. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Marquardt. I apologize for the chair being out of order on that one. Okay, now we have until 11:45. The Department of Revenue is going to give us an overview of auditing and appeals procedures. Thank you, Representative Murray. Thank you, Mr. Nelson, for your testimony on House File 103. We're going to bring folks from the department up to make a presentation, and members, you should have in your packets some handouts from the department. Who's this one from? Okay, I guess there are all these little handouts here, all from the department. So with that, we will, if you could please identify yourself for the record and who you represent, and please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And committee members, I'm Jack Manson with the Minnesota Department of Revenue. Along with me is Assistant Commissioner Terry Steenblock.
Excuse me, the Assistant Commissioner's name?
Terry Steenblock.
T-E-R-I?
Yep, Steenblock, S-T-E-E-N-B-L-O-C-K.
Just like it sounds, okay. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You did refer to these brochures that are in your packet. I'd like to draw your attention to this one-page chart as well. And it's entitled the Compliance Cycle. I know our focus is on audit today, but I'd like to kind of just run through this briefly if I could. This is really what the Department of Revenue is all about. When we talk about compliance, we usually talk about the bottom pieces there, the audit and enforcement pieces. But it actually is everything we do as part of the compliance cycle. We inform taxpayers, if you see at the kind of the upper left of this cycle, of their obligations and rights. And then we serve them by providing taxpayers with the services they need to meet those obligations. And then we process the returns, payments, refunds. Then we get into auditing that information, enforcement tools if we need it. And then you'll see we recommend changes to improve the revenue system. So if I could just briefly talk about each one of them a little bit. Under the information that we provide to taxpayers, I don't know, I hope you're all aware of our webpage. It's www.taxes.state.mn.us. It's a wealth of information. And we're continually updating that, and we're actually in the process of redesigning that web page to make it a little more user-friendly and a little more interactive. But on there you can find fact sheets by tax type, and it addresses all kinds of different issues and industry-wide issues. Our revenue notices are on there. Our annual newsletters are on there. We also are beginning to do more and more web videos now. We've got, I believe, 6 to 9 that are pertaining to the withholding tax area, but we're going to be adding sales tax and special taxes as we go along. We also have our taxpayer rights advocate brochures on there, and those are translated into different languages. Laotian, Hmong, and Spanish are some of the languages on there. We have a new thing we've added for business registration now is a check the box where you can actually ask for an educational call. So we'll call you for a new business and answer any questions and kind of help you get started along those lines. We're also looking at doing a new business webinar too, so kind of what to expect if you're a new business, what your obligations are as well. Under the service area, providing information, well, we actually provide $3.7 million forms for individual income taxpayers. We provide almost 800,000 property tax claims and serve over 200,000, 280,000 sales tax businesses and 200,000 corp and partnership and S-corps as well. We also offer online business services, so you can actually, as a business, you can look at your account history, your payment history, update your profiles. Any correspondence between you and the department is all available online with the password in a secured area. As far as processing as part of this compliance cycle, we provide forms and instructions to over four million taxpayers, and we process over 9.2 million transactions and payments. The audit piece of the cycle, we'll talk about that in more detail. I think that's really where your interest lies. In the enforcement area, which generates over $300 million a year, some of the tools we use in there are liens, levies, liquor posting, maybe heard about. The media likes to update everyone on those. Sales tax revocations,
Mr. Manson,
we do.
I'm sorry, if you would suspend, we do have a member with a question.
Okay.
Representative Gutwald.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Actually, I'll hold my question until later. I assume there will be some natural breaks here where we could ask some questions, but I just didn't let them present a little longer before I ask. Thank you.
Very well. Thank you. Please proceed, Mr. Thank Manson.
Thank you. Madam Chair and Representative, we could take a break right after I finish this page or before we go to the brochures. Might be a natural break. Thank you. So, and then on the recommendation, talk about improvements to the revenue system. That's an ongoing process for us. We do that year-round. As we do audits, we notice things that maybe need to be clarified or maybe need policy changes, and we send those to our legal department. They begin drafting them, and it's a year-round process, and hopefully you'll be hearing our department bill shortly in this committee. Then I just want to draw your attention to a couple of last things here. If you look at, there's kind of a gold, light gold shaded area. It talks about revenues of $16.8 million. That's what comes in voluntarily from taxpayers. We help them bring that in, but by processing the returns and such, but that comes in voluntarily. And then if you look at the bottom under audit and enforcement, there's some dollar items there. And those are really what we always talk about, compliance efforts, and that's like $625 million a year, roughly. So, and then the last couple of things I'd like to talk about is we, back about 7-8 years ago, we had 52% of our department expenditures went to the customer service and this other side of the ledger, and about 48% went to the actually auditing and collection side. Now, if we look ahead to this year, it's a 70-30 split. So, 30% is going now to that customer service information side, and 70% of our budget is now going to enforcement and audit. And then one last thing, if we look at full-time equivalents of employees, on the compliance side, since 2002, we've grown from 612 auditors and collectors to over 1,000, so about a 70% increase in the audit and collection side of the department. Whereas on the other side, the support side, we've gone from 500 employees to 350. So we've made quite a change in our environment in the department. A lot of that's helped by technology, though, too, on the side of that. So anyway, that's what I have on this first page. If there's any questions, now might be a good time. Or
all right. Thank you, Mr. Manson. All right, Representative Gutwald.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I want to preface my question or comment by saying I think this is more an issue for our tax committee members to discuss. We have, as a state, over the last couple of years, directed this department to increase their enforcement activities against small businesses. That's not their fault. In a sense, it's our fault. At a very time when we're trying to help small businesses survive, I have never in my entire career in politics, as a public servant, 14 years, heard the kind of outcry I've heard from small businesses in my district, small and medium-sized businesses, about the number of sales tax audits, the things that they're now being audited for that they never were audited for before, and the fines and levies that are being put against them. And again, I'm not blaming the department necessarily, because we directed them to do this. But I have at least a half a dozen who have been involved with me to a great extent about their sales tax audit concerns and fears, and probably another couple dozen who at various forums, business forums, have raised their hand and said, we've never seen this before. It is extraordinary. And the question, and what I'll ask the testifiers to speak to, is what led to that change, and what is it that we did to encourage you guys to do that, because I have never seen it before like this. I've got a couple of these businesses that are faced with fines and penalties that will, in fact, put them out of business. There will be layoffs, there will be loss of jobs, there will be loss of tax revenue as a result. And I think it's something we as a tax committee need to deal with. But Mr. Munson, I think I'd maybe make that question to you, Madam Chair.
Mr. Manson?
Madam Chair and Representative, that's kind of what I was trying to address at the bottom here, that growth in auditors and collectors by 70%. And just naturally, we're going to touch more taxpayers, more of your constituents. The up ramp kind of began in 2002 when the legislature did appropriate money directed at our compliance activities, and that's where we've really seen growth since then. So it's just something we're dealing with as well. And one of the issues that is kind of a byproduct of that is a lot of new auditors out there that really lack that experience of how to audit, and it's auditing is more of an art than a science, so it's the more you do, the more you learn, the better auditor you are. But we've got a lot of young people out there trying to do a good job, but don't have that savvy that maybe more of an experienced auditor might have. So,
Representative Gottwald.
Well, Madam Chair and members, I think we need to think about this long and hard. We are in fact putting a tremendous burden on some small businesses at a difficult time, and I understand the desire to gather more tax revenues. We're all looking for more money to try to balance the budget, but what we did recently is having some extremely negative impacts on people who have done their best to try to comply with our sales tax rules in the state of Minnesota, have experienced audits before, but have never experienced what we've visited upon them now. And I would argue that this is not what we should be doing at a time when we're trying to preserve jobs. 80% of new jobs are created by small businesses. They're the ones who are getting hit hardest by these. And again, I'm not necessarily blaming the department, although the inexperience of some of the auditors and some of the follow-up in regard to that has been a bit disconcerting. We as policymakers need to think long and hard about what we're doing right now.
Ms. Manson, response?
I agree with the concerns of Representative Gottwald. I mean, I've heard those before, and you know what, we're experiencing growing pains as well. But
all right, Representative Gottwald, are you okay? Thank you. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Mr. Manson, for coming in and helping us understand better the compliance cycle. I'm not sure if you know off the top of your head how many banks are in your audit cycle, but I just wanted to share with you that among our small banks in rural Minnesota, that the auditors used to come in and be, very cordial to the bank employees and to the directors, et cetera. And now I'm hearing that there's been this change in attitude. It's as though enforcement is becoming law enforcement, and I just want to share that with you. And I understand if you have new men and women as auditors, they're taking this very seriously and they're doing their job. But, you know, in rural Minnesota, where we've operated more on a community basis, this is not making good PR for the revenue department, at least in the compliance area. So I don't know if you know how many banks are being audited, and I'm sure there's reason. And in some cases, I think you end up owing them money instead of they're owing you money. But just this attitude, I think it's very important that people know that a government does serve a good purpose. But in rural Minnesota, DNR is one thing, but when I get calls that revenue is not being a very professional in their approach to audits, then I get a little concerned, because you're an agency that I think has, for the most part, maintained a very professional attitude, and so does the DNR. Those are just different issues, but I share that with you just for your information.
Mr. Madsen?
Madam Chair and Representative Erickson, we're concerned about the integrity of the department as well, and we're hearing some of these comments as well. One thing we've done is we're revamping our training program, and we're trying to teach the newer auditors more of these kind of people skills on how you deal with a taxpayer, how you answer questions, role-playing, kind of how important it is to keep your appointment for the audit, and a lot of these things that maybe we didn't have to teach in years prior that we're trying to revamp and bring into. We've done it in our sales tax program just recently. We're trying to expand that department-wide to other auditing and collection activities. So we're aware of that. We're very concerned about that. We did meet this fall a couple of times with a group of practitioners, 40 mainly CPAs, and it was very helpful. And they were actually hearing some of these, and they were concerned about our integrity as well, because we're a partnership, the two of us. And so we met with them. They gave us some great suggestions, and we've tried to incorporate some of those into what we're trying to do at the department. And we also, at the same time, kind of changed with them some of the things that we're doing too, so they were unaware of some of the things that we actually already do. So it's very helpful, though. We're incorporating a lot of those suggestions, but we are aware of this kind of these personality skills, and we're trying to deal with them the best we can, and you know, hopefully we'll be doing better in the future.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Madam Chairwoman. Mr. Munson, I know that we put you in the difficult spot. You know, that's been that requirement of the legislature. But if I note in here that it's for a defined period of time, 2010-11, and so when this fiscal year ends, you know, this was designed to bring in a certain amount of revenue by doing this tax compliance. But what I'm seeing in here is that that's 2010-11. Do you know, is that due to just continue on into the future, or is this a one-time only?
Mr. Manson.
Madam Chair and Representative Kiffmeyer, those are permanent positions, so those will now be part of our baseline. So those are permanent positions. They'll be ongoing positions.
Follow-up, Representative Kiffmeyer.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. And so if they are permanent positions, but the task was only given for the 2 years, I mean, because you were funded $10 million, let's see, $10.36 million was funded to you in the 10-11 biennium to generate the $41.5 million in revenue. So how would you continue these employees without additional these fundings?
Madam Chair and Representative Kiffmeyer, those are built. That was new money that we were appropriated, but the appropriation extends ongoing. So those are permanent positions, but it was a new initiative, a new appropriation, and it was linked to this new revenues. But we did get permanent funding, so those positions are ongoing.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. And so I understand it was built into your base. So this would continue to go forward.
Madam Chair and Representative, that's correct.
Okay, I would have a concern about that, members, if we're going
Representative
to...
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Madam Chairwoman. I would have a concern about that for us as members that, you know, we ought to seriously take a look at this, whether we want to continue. Thank you. That's it.
Thank you, Representative Kiffmeyer. Now, members, we have a couple other people on the list that are asking questions. If it's not pertinent to what has already been presented, it would be great if we could have Mr. Manson proceed. I have Runbeck and Gottwalt that are on the list right now, but if we could have Mr. Manson proceed, I don't see any objections to that. Representative Paymar, do you have a question to what has been...
I mean, there seems to be some criticism of the department here, and maybe some of it's justified in terms of how they're conducting their audits and how they're treating small businesses, but I just want to be clear, or maybe I need some clarification. We are looking at $40 million that was owed to the state, if I'm correct, that was not paid for whatever reason, if it was ignorance, if it was... this is money that other small businesses are... They're paying their sales taxes, and other small businesses aren't, for whatever reason. Am I correct?
Mr. Manson?
Madam Chair and Representative, you're correct.
So I don't understand why we would want...
Representative Paymar?
I'm sorry, Madam Chair. I don't understand why we would want to reduce the appropriation to the department. If they need better training, et cetera, that's one thing. But, you know, that's money that you know, my small business people pay, your small business people pay, and other people don't for whatever reason. And that, I just want to make that clear.
Well, thank you, Representative Paymar, and I don't think that people are blaming necessarily the department for this. Mr. Manson, I know when we had this question the last go-around, I think the concern was, is are we getting the rate of return on the money that's already been invested? That was one of my questions in looking at the fact that we have that you were provided with $10.3 million to collect an additional $41.5 million. So I think the question is are we actually being able to achieve that in a cost-effective way? And it looks like you've already spent the $4.3 million and we've only collected an additional you've expended $4.3 million and only collected about $10.3 million with that amount of money. So, but that's, you know, in the next portion that you haven't had a chance to present on yet. And I know Representative Lencheski, you had some comments. I know Runbeck has, Gottwald. Is it Representative Runbeck, you're next on deck, is it, to this point?
Well, it really is, Madam Chair, and I think that the issue is, you know, time management, efficiency of the use of funds, and I won't say I've heard a lot of comments to this effect, but I have heard several that these audits now are being conducted sort of double-teaming, two auditors on one, you know, constituent, one taxpayer, and even the IRS, I mean, is not ever, unless they're in a total training mode, they don't do more than one auditor per audit. So this is very interesting. You know, is this a new trend? And, you know, does it suggest that there's perhaps diminishing returns, you know, in terms of the money we're spending and the benefits, the cost benefit?
Mr. Manson, do you wish to comment?
Madam Chair and Representative Runbeck, we are seeing diminishing returns since 2002, where the compliance initiatives did bring in about 10 to 1, and now we're targeting like 4 to 1. So we are seeing diminishing returns, and we're also touching more of your constituents as we grow here. So it's really a question of, how long this will be continued provide revenues, but it seems like it's still at 4 to 1 as of now.
Representative Runbeck.
Well, just real quick, Madam Chair and Mr. Manson, my constituent, nice to see you. but I do think it's an issue, and I don't know if it's a management issue or a supervisor issue, but I would, you know, appreciate some feedback on it, because folks who go through IRS audits as CPAs don't ever experience more than one auditor on a case. So, you know, what is the double teaming all about? And especially when it's for, you know, very questionable small amounts, to continue to work it, you know, hour after hour, when there's very little in dispute. Okay?
Mr. Manson.
Madam Chair and Representative Runbeck, I don't think joint audits is uncommon for us. I know even in corporate income tax, we actually have normally three people doing an audit. When we met with this practitioner group, they suggested we do more joint audits, more shadowing audits, rather than sending audits out by themselves. So that was really actually their preference, that instead of a young auditor going out and trying to do an audit that maybe might not be a big change in tax, but they're learning the system, that they preferred that we actually do joint audits where they learn from a more experienced auditor on site. So. That's part of why we're doing maybe more joint audits, but it's more of a learning, mentoring experience.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. We have Gottwald, Lencheski, and Wardlow. Representative Gottwald.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I realize we want to get on with the presentation here, but I need to at least respond to what Representative Paymar said, because I think he might be ignoring what the issue here is. This is not, a group of people who are trying to circumvent legitimate tax laws or paying legitimate taxes. In fact, the people I've talked to say, hey, if I've made a mistake, great. What we're hearing, and this is not just from one or two or three, but at least half a dozen I've worked with very closely, and many others who I've heard from anecdotally, is that the rules or laws are being applied in a different way, so that they've been audited before, they've corrected things to follow the rules the way they thought they were laid out, and now suddenly they're being applied differently, and they're ending up having thousands of dollars, tens of thousands, even more, applied to them. We clearly turned the department loose on these people, and I understand the desire to collect sales taxes, but how this is being done has been extraordinary. And then beyond that, I think something we need to deal with as a committee is, do we want to take a stance of throwing the book at people when these things happen and putting them out of business regardless, Or as one suggested, look, if I've done something wrong, show me it, levy a fine against me, and come back next year and see if I've done it right. It seems to me an appropriate approach. What's happening instead is we triple the amounts of money for the back taxes, and these people end up with bills to pay that they simply can't. In some cases, these two- or three-person shops are out of business as a result. So I think it's the intensity, it's kind of the changing of the approach on the taxes, and then it's the attitude with which we're taking this approach with particularly small employers.
Madam Chair, to that point.
Representative Paymar.
Representative Gottwald, I did not say that. My question was very clear. I did not say that businesses were trying to circumvent the rules. So for the record, I just want to be clear about that. I'm quite sure that it's ignorance of the rules, changes in the rules that are causing this, which to me is a separate issue. I'm sure you don't want to get into it because you want to interpret things the way you want to interpret things.
Thank you, Representative Paymar. Members, here's what we're going to do. We have Lincheski, and then we have Representative Wardlow, and after that, then we're going to proceed with the presentation. Representative Lincheski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you to Chair Davids for hearing this today, and I just want to remind members who maybe have forgotten this account does not sit in this committee. This is not the work of this committee. This is the work of Representative Lanning's committee, and they hold the budget, and they decide how much tax compliance initiatives they want to do, but generally, as a rule, the tax committees hear them to kind of understand it, but this account doesn't even reside in this committee, and those tax compliance initiatives happened under Representative Kahn. With negotiations with the people on this committee and Governor Plenty. So, I mean, just to understand in the past recent years on tax compliance, I mean, these have been Governor Plenty's initiatives as well. It is frustrating to have people feel like they're being, you know, shaken down. And, I was audited this year, and I understand how that works. And I just want to say there's a reason for us to be doing this.
Representative Lincheski, I just have to comment on that. I think it's kind of funny that the tax chair was audited, former tax chair. So.
And I was off by I was off by $105, and I can't remember if I owed it or they owed it to me, but it was $105. But
Representative Lincheski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. But, you know, if people are interested in learning about this, and Representative Gottwald, I know how to leave, but this is it. I mean, this is what prompted it. It was this study by the Office of the Legislative Auditor, the Tax Compliance Report. Read it. We have $1 billion that we don't collect, $1 billion in owed taxes. So, you know, this isn't, you know, just looking for money for nothing. We're missing $1 billion that's owed. And so why should we care? Well, because everybody else pays more in taxes because $1 billion is not getting collected. So no matter what level of spending you want in government, if you want $10 or $100, if you got to get $10 and $1 billion's missing, somebody else has to pay it. So what this report found and why action was taken is about 10% of all taxes were not being collected in every category. About 10 cents on the dollar were missing. And pick any category, there it was. The study also went on to show that about 70% of the missing money happens in about 10% of the cases. So there was a very strategic effort to direct the Department of Revenue to get at those resources. And is it uncomfortable for people to find out that they owe taxes? Sure. I mean, and it do occasionally people get audited and everything's fine. That's true, too. It's uncomfortable. But why would any state legislature want to ensure that there's tax compliance? There's a ripple effect that happens when you make tax compliance is you build the integrity and belief in the system. And when people doubt that the system's fair, then they're angry. Then they don't pay taxes. Then they do different things. When people know that, hey, if I don't follow the rules, I will get caught, more people comply. I mean, it's absolutely an intentional, by design effort that happened under Governor Plenty with the legislature to ensure that people are paying taxes owed. So, yep, it's not fun to be audited, and I don't think the Department of Revenue relishes that, but I think people should just know that there was a very strong need found by our Office of the Legislative Auditor, who told us we're not doing a good job. And so revenue has been going and trying to fix that up, and people squawk when things happen, and I understand that, but I really I want to own that because I was a strong supporter of it. And so if people are mad, I hope they will call me directly, no matter where they reside in the state. I'll own that because I think it was the right thing to do, and I think when we don't collect the tax that's owed, everybody who doesn't owe it has to pay more. to make up for those who aren't paying. So there is a huge fairness issue in tax compliance, and I appreciate you letting me make that comment, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Lencheski. Representative Wardlow.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm looking here at the agency profile and the tax compliance narrative that goes over. There's a chart, tax compliance initiative summary, that by biennium shows revenue targets, appropriated amounts of money, the expected return on investment, and the actual return on investment, and the actual revenue collected under the initiative. A simple question here, I think. Exactly how were the revenue targets listed for each biennium determined, and perhaps that has something to do with the reports that Representative Lencheski referenced, and why in each instance for the last four bienniums were actual tax revenues collected under the initiatives over the revenue targets by, you know, in the range of 25% to 60%. It seems to me that that perhaps evidences the overzealousness you were talking about earlier, but it is somewhat troublesome that with the appropriations given and the revenue target set, we're exceeding that revenue target by such substantial margins, and then I guess whether that's okay or not would depend on how the revenue targets are set. So if you could shed some light on that, I'd appreciate it.
Mr. Manson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Wardlow, the appropriation and the targets, generally how it works is they asked us for kind of a recommendation on what we can do, and then they take that under, you, the legislature, takes that under consideration and appropriates what they feel is necessary and then ties a revenue target to that. There's a lot of issues about, as I've said before, is kind of that return on investment is coming down, so how far is it going to go down next time is always a big question mark. And I think there's some feelings that to err on being a little more conservative when you're budgeting, when you're putting your budget together, so maybe they tend to have been a little understated, but currently the target is 4-to-1, and we have generally exceeded those targets, but there's just this concern about, you know, when's the number going to keep drop significantly or keep dropping. And
Representative Wardlow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A quick follow-up then. It just seems to me that as the actual revenue over the target decreases biennium by biennium, is it fair to analogize that it's kind of we're squeezing as much juice out of an apple or an orange as we can, and we're getting to the point where there's nothing left to be squeezed, and we're putting a lot of pressure on these taxpayers?
Mr. Manson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Wardlow, there's pressure within the agency to meet these targets. More compliance initiatives are going to add to compliance auditors and collector staff, and we will be visiting more taxpayers and looking at more issues, but...
Representative Wardlow. Okay, please proceed, Mr. Manson.
Then we could just move to these brochures. I'm not going to go through them all. There are a lot of overlap. Maybe we could just start with the audit process. It's kind of purple colored. And just want to draw your attention to a couple items in here. With regards to the time limits, so sometimes I get questions on this. We usually have 3.5 years after return is filed to do the audit. And generally, the biggest exception to that is whether the IRS has amended your return or you've adjusted that return. If you extend it for the IRS, that also extends it for Minnesota. It talks about when we contact you, some of the information we'll need. It talks about all the information you provide to us is kept confidential, but we can share that information with the IRS or other state agencies. And then on the back, it talks a little bit about after the audit. One thing to draw, maybe you should be aware of, is if you're entitled to a refund, we do offset refunds for other Minnesota taxes you owe, any debts you owe to another state agency or county agency. If you owe felony crimes or fines, restitution, and child support also offsets your income or sales tax or any tax refunds. So that's that brochure.
Mr. Manson, yes. Is it standard procedure for tax chairs to be audited? When Representative Lencheski said that, I'm not nervous because you can audit me anytime you'd like, but is that like normal?
Representative Erickson was too.
I was too.
Holy smokes. You got to be concerned about being on this committee. Is it just random, I'm hoping?
Mr. Chair, we really don't have any preferences.
Because when I was audited one time, and actually they owed me money, so, you know.
Well,
Please proceed, sir.
Mr. Chair, our mission is that, or motto is that Minnesotans pay no more tax or no less than they owe. So if we do an audit, we'll issue a refund as well as we'll make an assessment.
Please proceed, sir.
Okay, just then I draw your attention to this gold brochure. A couple of things in here. This one now gets more into after the audit and kind of your appeals rights. So if you disagree with the audit, you can appeal informally to the Department of Revenue. That's kind of an independent unit within our department, and you don't need counsel. You can just come send in new information. You've got 60 days to do that after an audit, but it talks about some of the information that you should include in your appeal. You also can ask for an informal conference where we'll meet with you with or without a representative. If you want a representative with you, you need to fill out a power of attorney so we can share information with that individual. And then it talks about, also gives you a little more information on if you decide to appeal to the tax court, which you can also do within 60 days. You can go to the regular division tax court, or you can go to small appeals division if it's under $5,000. So that's kind of some of the information in there, kind of the next step. And then if you look at the green brochure, this is our Minnesota Taxpayer Rights. We have a independent unit, Taxpayer Rights Advocacy Office. They kind of are the go-betweens between the divisions and the taxpayer, so kind of a liaison position. And we've got three individuals that work in that unit. But this really gets into more of your rights and responsibilities. As a taxpayer, you're required to provide complete and accurate information. We as a department have a responsibility to keep that personal and financial information confidential. It talks a little bit about the audit process. I'm going to get into that a little bit. I think that's kind of what you want to hear about. But this brochure gets into more of the collection process. So it talks about liens and levies and business liabilities. So you as a business owner, as an officer, are responsible for sales and withholding liabilities too. Then, if you want to go to the last brochure, whatever color that is, it's understanding this one's
lavender, Mr. Mann.
The lavender?
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So this one's understanding the sales and use tax process, which is probably a lot of what you're hearing from your constituents. So this one's specific that they hand out on an audit, and it really tells the taxpayer what to expect during the audit process. So if you open that up, it talks about, I guess, first is what is a tax audit, and one thing that they mention here is, since your business is not exactly like any other business, your audit may not be the same as somebody else's. Sometimes we hear from a constituent, well, I talked to my associate over here and they didn't do that. Well, businesses differ, the auditor's approach, technique differ as well. So there's always going to be a difference in audit to audit. And so that's one thing to keep in mind. But it talks about review your records. We'll explain any errors you've made. We'll recommend changes on how you should keep your records to eliminate any errors in the future. We'll give you an audit report at the end detailing your necessary changes and explain those. And then we're available after the audit to help you answer your questions and concerns. One thing, I know it's also... we hear about imposition, you know, on the small owners. They're a one-person business or whatever. And one thing we're looking at right now is the extranet capability, where we can actually share information secured collect this audit information with taxpayers, and that might save some of our actually being in their office space. And so that's one thing we're pursuing on that side. But we do in here encourage the taxpayer to be involved in the audit process. They also can have somebody with them, a representative, a CPA, or an attorney with them if they prefer. It talks about at the start, we'll discuss what records we need to review and when we'll need to review those. We encourage them not to be afraid to ask questions. A big part of what we hope from our auditing, their auditing experience, is some education too on how they can do things better in the future, maybe do things easier. We also mention here that anytime during the audit process, if they have concerns about the procedures the auditor's using, that they can contact his or her supervisor. This is another new suggestion from the CPA groups we met with, that we provide that information right up front in the appointment letter, so that it's not at a point where it's a contentious issue and they've got to ask, well, who's your supervisor? I want to talk to them. So I think that was a pretty good suggestion by them. So we are adding that to all of our audit letters now as well. Then it talks about what we look at. There's a long list of sales invoices, journals, exemption certificates. So if they don't charge tax on a transaction, they've got to get an exemption certificate. Explains why they didn't charge the tax. Purchase orders, especially on their fixed assets, so we can tell if they paid the tax. One of the big issues is use tax sometimes, where they buy equipment, products from outside Minnesota, they don't pay the tax. The retailer's not required to collect the tax, so then they're owed this use tax, so that's an issue on a lot of audits. So it's really a balance of requesting too much information and too little, so we don't have to keep requesting information. So, and then we talked about auditing your sales and your purchases. Not much there. Sampling audit, that's something we do in sales tax generally. And if you've got a lot of records, we're generally doing a three-year audit period. We don't want to look at every invoice. We don't want you to have to drag out every invoice. So what we do is do a sample audit. We either look at a blocks of months, perhaps, that would be representative of other years, or else we just kind of randomly do a sample of invoices. And our goal there is to, whatever method we decide to do, that we have an agreement with the taxpayer that, yes, this is representative. You know, how it shakes out is a different question, but at least they're okay with that.
So, Mr. Manson, what you would do is, if they have all these receipts, you'll take 1 month's worth and then extrapolate that to 12 months or something like that?
Correct, Mr. Chair.
But the Mr. Manson, the taxpayer has to agree to that beforehand, because I know we run into trouble with that, like with Delta Dental. They'll go in a dentist's office and they'll do 1 month and they'll say there was this many off in 1 month, so we're going to charge you this much. But you would have the agreement beforehand?
Mr. Chairman, it's our intent to have an agreement that makes sense, and that's what we strive for. And we do mention in this brochure that, you know, if they don't agree with the sampling method, that they can talk to that auditor supervisor and maybe make some objections. But generally, our hope is to have an agreement that makes
sense. Mr. Manson, have you seen these TV commercials where they come out and say, if you owe the IRS $2 million, call Joe Schmo, and he'll get shot? Then they come on and say, I owed $2 million, but only had to pay $100,000. You know, do we deal with that at the state level? I know that they're talking IRS stuff, but that kind of angers me, because if they owe $2 million, maybe they should pay $2 million.
Mr. Chair, I'm waiting for when I hit the rule of 90, then I'm going to do that work.
Oh, okay. No. Yeah. We have 25 former IRS agents that will stick it to the IRS and, yeah, you know, call 1-800, stick it to the United States type thing. Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, I haven't seen any advertising along the state lines, but I have seen those commercials, and good luck to them.
Please proceed, Mr. Manson.
Okay. And then when we're done, it talks a little bit about after the audit. If you've got a notice, you've got 60 days to pay that notice, or you can appeal it or file in tax court. So some of that information that we already covered.
Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to that point, Mr. Manson, I had heard only just, you know, vaguely, but that there may be log jams in the tax court for these appeals. I mean, is that true? And, you know, what does that do to? And here it even says you have 18 months to file a lawsuit, but I'm hearing that there's actually 18 months of a backlog before you can get your case heard.
Mr. Manson?
Mr. Chair and Representative Runbeck, I am not sure about actually the backlog in the tax courts. I know we are seeing some instances where taxpayers, rather than going to our informal appeal process, are jumping into tax court. so I'm not sure about that. I've heard some concern about the appeals in within the department. And, of course, we're seeing more because we're doing more audits. But,
Mr. Chair and
Representative Runbeck,
would you please, would you check on that for me and get back to me? I'd appreciate that.
Okay.
Mr. Manson.
We'll do so, Mr.
Thank
Chair.
You.
And could you notify the entire committee if we've got some backlogs here and how long it's taking to, because these things should be, you know, expedited, in my opinion, and get them through and done and get on with life. Representative Daraskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Matson, when you go in both with the income tax and the sales tax audits, do you stop at the current year's discovery process, or do you, if you catch fish, do you go to the other pond? I mean, do you go back to the year before and the year before that, or do you simply help get them on the right course for the current year and set them to sail correctly in the future?
Mr. Manson.
Mr. Chair and Representative, well, generally when we're doing an audit, we're looking at a three-year period. So we address the issues in all 3 years, unless it's a case of a non-filer where we can go back far further back. But so generally we do a three-year period, and really that's just the kind of, so we can visit a taxpayer and then get out of their life for the next 3 years. So that's why we try and do multiple years at a time. It's convenient for the taxpayer and more efficient for the department as well. But we usually do more than 1 year in an audit.
Representative Draskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Manson, what to what level does the use of all 3 years add to the complication for the taxpayer relative to that audit?
Mr. Manson.
Mr. Chair and Representative, I don't know if it's more complicated or not. I think it might be the same issue through the whole period. Hopefully, as far as like talked about sampling and stuff, hopefully that helps them from pulling all the records of 3 years. They just piece of each year or maybe 1 year that we can extrapolate onto the other years. But I would think the taxpayer's preference would be kind of for us to look at a period and then and move on. But
Representative Draskowski.
No, thanks, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Manson. Please proceed.
Mr. Chair, I think that's about it for the brochures. Like I said, there's a lot of overlap, and I don't want to keep reading through the brochure. But
any questions for Mr. Manson? Are you done with your presentation? Are there others that wish to present some issues or items? Or,
Mr. Chair, I think we're set.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay, members, we will be adjourning in a second here, and we will be canceling committee for tomorrow. Next committee meeting will be Tuesday at the regular scheduled time. So with that, good government all the time. We are adjourned.